You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. After a violent weekend in Venezuela, the U.S. says all options are on the table in removing President Nicolas Maduro's regime. We'll get the latest coming up.
Now, food insecurity is an issue that has persisted in the United States for decades and emerged as a critical yet often overlooked civil rights issue. In the southern U.S. in the 1960s, activist Fannie Lou Hamer purchased land in the Mississippi Delta and started the Freedom Farms Cooperative as a way to help empower black tenant farmers and sharecroppers.
Hamer's original project inspired similar food independence movements throughout the country. And our next guest is here to talk about the political legacy and future of black agriculture in cities like Milwaukee, Detroit, and New Orleans.
Monica White is an assistant professor of environmental justice at the UW-Madison. She's the author of the new book, Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance and the Black Freedom Movement. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
Well, I think when people think of black farmers and agriculture in the United States, they might think of slavery or exploitative sharecropping.
Right.
Negative.
Sure.
You are looking at the positive side of African Americans in farming. Can you talk about the importance of telling that part of the story?
Sure. I think that when you are talking about the legacies of race and agriculture, in order to get young people involved, it's really difficult to talk about why we should grow food if the only frame is a deficit model or a negative negative approach. And so sharecropping, tenant farming, and slavery are negative lenses through which we can understand. And yet the folks that are involved in urban agricultural projects like food security and food justice movements don't use that as a lens. And so I wanted to elevate the history of race and agriculture from the perspective of those who have done so willingly.
Now, you start earlier in this, but I want to jump right to Fannie Lou Hamer and the Freedom Farms Cooperative. Can you talk a little bit about her story
Sure.
in promoting a positive relationship with land in Mississippi?
So what happened was, after Mrs. Hamer returned to Mississippi and was allowed to register to vote, she was evicted and was fired from her job. And so she realized at that moment that it wasn't just enough to have the right to vote, but that that was a primary way to encourage people to engage in the transformation of their own lives, and so wanted to start an entity that would allow people to look at, out for each other collectively. And that was where Freedom Farms Agricultural Cooperative came from.
And I want to hammer a point home here that I guess I wasn't that familiar with. For black people in Mississippi, when they actually use their right to vote, they risked being fired and or evicted from their farmland.
Or death, right? Mm-hmm. So registering to vote and trying to, demonstrate your own sort of citizen right was also grounds for death. So, yes, it was very much life and death.
And can you talk about then the model that she and then
yes.
others helped develop?
Sure. So to think about what it must have felt like to be beholden to someone who wanted to exploit your labor, and knowing that voting meant you were homeless and unemployed, to then turn to Mrs. Hamer and to see what she was doing with Freedom Farm. There was commercial kitchen and food preservation. There were community gardens and growing spaces. There was wild, all kinds of strategies and techniques for community wellness. And that then was a stark contrast to where they were previously, and thinking about building on the skills that they had, which was, we know how to grow. They may not have known how to grow food. They may have grown cash crops, but how can we grow and use food production as a cornerstone of this cooperative, or this collective, or this community?
And a point that keeps coming up in your book, wherever we're talking about, from the Deep South to Midwestern yeah. big cities, is the economic side, sure, but also this building of community and people empowering themselves together.
That's right. As a sociologist, I often ask myself, what does food allow us to do? And how have we used food as an instrument to transform our community? We know we use food as a love language. We grow food. We cook food. We talk about food. But food also serves as a way to demonstrate culture and, I think, argues is the foundation for building sustainable communities. And we can learn a lot from what's happening in Detroit.
And we'll get to Detroit in a minute. I don't want to leave the South yet, because this isn't just
yeah.
history. You
That's
yourself
right.
have visited still active
right.
descendants of
That's
these
right.
original farming cooperatives.
That's right. And Mr. Burkett, he's third generation farmer in Peddle, Mississippi, tells me all the time, the land has been in his family since the 1800s. He's an African-American farmer. And he is absolutely convinced that if it hadn't been for the cooperatives, he may not still be a farmer today.
Another project, I think it was one in Texas you wrote about, correct me if I'm wrong, but they were starting a cooperative. They wanted to do things like make pickles and sell them, except nobody would sell them the seeds. And then white grocers wouldn't buy their produce.
That's right. So the cooperatives were very much an economic but a political force. And there were there's lots of evidence that says that white farmers who organized into cooperatives and collectives were applauded for the amount of, you know, profit they were able to make. When African Americans did the same thing, it was seen as a sinister intention, or it was, you know, aligned with negative sorts of political goals and ambitions, when we wanted the same thing with everybody, which is to grow food and to build community around it.
We're talking to Monica White about her new book, Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance and the Black Freedom Movement. She is an assistant professor of environmental justice at UW-Madison. Well, let's take things to the cities now. You spent a lot of time looking at agriculture in Detroit.
Yes.
What did you find there?
So I moved back to Detroit to help care for my parents, and this was the beginning of this new moment of urban agriculture, and was really amazed that the stories that I heard didn't look like anything that any of the people that I knew. And so I wanted to hear, where were the African Americans who have been living in the city and whose parents moved from Alabama mostly, but from the South, who escaped agriculture because of the exploitative conditions, moved here to work in the automobile industry. Here's another economic moment when we're turning to agriculture to build a community or a sense of community. And so just was amazed by the folks who would say stuff like, it isn't just for me, it isn't for my family. I want to make sure that there's community wellness. I'm concerned about the kids who are walking to school that aren't my children, but I want to make sure that folks have access to nutrient-rich food. And so found a lot of activities and ideas about what's happening and how food allows us to transform our neighborhoods.
And we've had conversations with people doing similar things in Milwaukee, various kinds of urban gardening, community gardens, things like that. How important are those in community building?
I think it's tremendous, because for the folks in Detroit, if we can think about increasing our access to nutrient-rich food, what else can we do? We can think about community engagement and education, community policing. We can talk and think about being concerned about one another. So food allows us the conversation starter on using food as a strategy for resilience and resistance.
I think a lot of people might think of the sharecroppers in the South as victims, people in African Americans in urban environments as victims of bad economic conditions, segregation, racism. You're centering them as actors in a lot of ways, people who are trying to take control of their own destiny.
That's
Can you talk about the importance of thinking in that way?
Sure. I think that each of us has agency, right? The decision, the capacity to make a decision to change the economic, social, and political goal or you know, the aspects of my life. But to see people use food as the conduit through, or the instrument through which to transform community, just really is heartening. When you hear and think about what's happening in Detroit, a lot of people think both a negative perspective, but then also there are certain areas of Detroit that are reviving. I think we can't do a full analysis and assessment of what's happening in Detroit until we talk about the Detroiters and the folks that are actively transforming community and doing so with barely anything outside of the will and seeds and the muscle.
I want to take things back now to the civil rights movement and an overlooked part of that, again, I wasn't familiar with. We think of freedom riders going there from the North. We think of urban movements, civil rights movements.
Right.
But you found that black farmers played a big role working with bailing out, in some cases, freedom riders and others.
That's right. It's impossible to talk about a freedom summer without the folks who fed, housed, and even in some cases clothed the students who came down. But yet that part of the story has been overlooked. Civil rights movement talks a lot about, we know about ministers, we know about music, we know about all kinds of things, but we really don't know enough about the rural communities and the farmers who did so much in terms of civil rights movement. And I hope that this book adds that conversation for that missing piece of history.
I know going back as far as Frederick Douglass, probably earlier, there have been advocates for African Americans maintaining that connection with the land and agriculture. Are you hoping that that relationship gets rebuilt now, 2019?
Mrs. Hamer said, when you leave the land, you leave everything. Everything comes from the land. And so when you have access to land, you have access to what those resources are, then there's a lot of transformation that can take place. I am hopeful that this book gives us a different conversation from tenant farming, slavery, and sharecropping, but I'm also hoping that it gives us a way to look and think about resistance outside of protests, marches, and boycotts. We can actually create the kind of world we want to see.
Monica, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This was fun.
Monica White is an assistant professor of environmental justice at UW-Madison. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Freedom Farmers, Agricultural Resistance, and the Black Freedom Movement.
Coming up, we'll get the latest on the unrest in Venezuela and the ongoing American response. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest explains why he says the rush to judgment in the Jesse Smollett case is proof of confirmation bias and a desire to advance a political agenda.
First, Vice President Mike Pence is meeting with Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido in neighboring Colombia today. The two were expected to discuss plans to unseat President Nicolas Maduro.
The visit comes after a U.S.-backed effort to deliver humanitarian aid from Colombia ended in violence this weekend. Forces loyal to Maduro fired tear gas and buckshot at activists trying to deliver those supplies. They also lit some of the materials on fire. At least two people were killed and 300 wounded.
Speaking yesterday on Fox News Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo would not rule out American military force to oust the Maduro regime.
We've set every options on the table. We're going to do the things that need to be done to make sure that the Venezuelan people's voice, that democracy reigns, and that there's a brighter future for the people of Venezuela.
All right. Eduardo Gamarra is a professor of political science and the founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. He also researched and served as a consultant in Venezuela and other Latin American countries. He joins us now to talk about the latest news from that country. Eduardo, welcome to Central Time. Eduardo, do we have you? And we...
Hello?
Hi, Eduardo, are you there?
Hi. Yeah, I'm sorry there was an interruption there. Anyway, pleasure to be with you.
Okay, glad to have you. Glad you're here. Let's dig right in, and let's take a step back and just review how we got here. We have two men both claiming to be Venezuela's president. We've got Maduro, who won an election last year and was sworn in last month, and Guaido, who is the president of the National Assembly. Why are both men arguing that they are in charge of the country?
It's a long story. I'll be brief. Maduro was elected president via what many claim to be a fraudulent election last year. The problem with that election is that it was convoked by a constituent assembly that he called in his attempt to forestall an attempt to call a recall referendum that would have ended his presidency early. The recall referendum was called by the National Assembly, an assembly that is dominated by the opposition, an opposition that won an overwhelming victory at the polls in December of 2016. So essentially what you have is a legislative body elected by the Constitution and a legislative body called the Constituent Assembly elected by just simply Maduro's followers, which then convoked an election that essentially elected Maduro. Now, Maduro's term was supposed to end, his constitutional term was supposed to end on January the 10th. On January the 10th, the opposition claimed was the end of his term. Therefore, after January the 10th, there was a vacancy in the presidency. Maduro had himself sworn in by that constituent assembly that he selected. And of course, under the Constitution, when there is a vacancy in the presidency, then the president of the National Assembly becomes interim president for a period of 30 days, during which he has to call for elections. So I know that's complicated, but that's essentially where we are today.
Well, and let's talk about the circumstances even leading up to this in the first place. I think in order to fully understand what's happening now, we have to talk about the economic situation in Venezuela. What have we seen there in the last couple of years?
Well, Venezuela is probably, I would say, a unique case in world history. It is the wealthiest country in Latin America. And probably, just given its natural resources, we might say that it's maybe even proportionately wealthier than the United States. Yet it is also an incredible case of economic mismanagement. It has right now, according to most calculations, somewhere between 2 and 10 million% hyperinflation. Projections are that at current rates, it could reach as high as 20 million% hyperinflation by December. Now, I lived in Bolivia with 26,000% hyperinflation in the mid-1980s, and I can tell you that it was difficult to calculate then what anything costs from second to second. I can only imagine what it is like today in Venezuela.
We are talking with Eduardo Gamarra. He is a professor of political science and the founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. And we are talking about what's happening right now in the country of Venezuela. And as we mentioned earlier, Vice President Mike Pence is currently in Colombia meeting with Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido. What do we know about what they're talking about today and in the coming days?
Well, the meeting in Bogota really brings together the Latin American democratically elected governments in a group called the Lima Group, headed by the Colombian president, but it also includes presidents like the president, the newly elected president of Brazil, Bolsonaro, the president of Peru, and in total about 16 countries, including the United States and Canada. They are the ones who have essentially not recognized Maduro as president. They have imposed sanctions, and those sanctions, of course, are the ones that are having the kind of impact on the Venezuelan economy that's essentially accelerating also the rate of hyperinflation. They are discussing the incidents or the events of Saturday when the convoy of humanitarian assistance was essentially fired upon by the police forces, the National Guard in Venezuela, and none of the aid was allowed into the country. So the group now, with Vice President Pence, is discussing options what to do now following Saturday. Will they find additional sanctions? And it's hard to think about how many more sanctions can be imposed. And in fact, there's probably, because the U.S. has put it on the table, there's probably also discussion of what military options might be considered.
Do we know anything about the level of support for the Maduro regime within the country right now? According to the BBC, there were more than 100 soldiers that defected over the weekend during what you were just talking about. So what do we know about the amount of support that that regime currently has within the country?
Look, I've been conducting public opinion polls in Venezuela for about a decade. We stopped about a year ago. It's interesting, but Maduro still has a modicum of popular support, largely people that have benefited extensively from his social programs and the like. By the same token, the military is one of the most important beneficiaries of the kind of patronage and support that Maduro and the whole Chavez regime, going back to the early 2000s, really bestowed on the military, with an awful lot of presence from Cuba. And this is really what's significant. The role that Cuba has played in the strengthening, the training, and really the ideological, indoctrination of the Venezuelan military. So while we have now reports of a significant number of defections, we still don't have the kind of defections that we will need to see any change in the military structure there.
Secretary of State Pompeo, as we heard in the intro there, has said all options are on the table for the United States and how they may work to remove Maduro from power. And military action is not off the table here. And I'm wondering if you see that having to be the case, if American military forces will need to get involved here.
There are a couple of things that I'm concerned about, and I think most people who know Venezuela are concerned about. One, the humanitarian action on Saturday did not have, any kind of, well, what do we do if it fails, other than escalating this into what the U.S. has been saying now for over a year. President Trump has been threatening some form or other of military action in Venezuela. And this has raised an enormous amount of expectations, especially from people that are just waiting to see the regime fall. And these expectations, of course, are unreasonable, because Venezuela is not Panama, for example, where the U.S. intervened in the late 80s. It's not Grenada, where the U.S. intervened in the early 80s. This is a very complex country, and the Venezuelan conflict is no longer just a Venezuelan conflict. It involves the United States, the rest of South America, and so on. But it also involves other key actors like Russia and China in particular. So I think, you know, that it's dangerous to talk about military intervention as if we could just simply resolve the Venezuelan situation overnight. I think that would be a protracted conflict. Even though Venezuela is not Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, this is a Western country, as Senator Rubio likes to say. But I think it would certainly not be a cakewalk just going in and taking over Caracas. And more importantly, I think the rebuilding of Venezuela is also very, very complex over the long term. So I think, you know, it's while it's easy to say that the military option is on the table, I think practically speaking, I think our policymakers ought to be a little bit more careful.
And in our last minute together, Eduardo, what are you going to be watching for going forward in the next week or so? What will you be looking for?
Well, I'm going to be very attentive to see what comes out of the Bogota meeting that took place today, and see what concrete actions the Latin American presidents are going to put forth with their Canadian and U.S. counterparts. I think that's the first thing to look forward to. The next thing, of course, is what Maduro himself will do, because, you know, as we said earlier, while he may have, let's say he has 300,000 people that still support him and that he can still put out on the streets along with the military. I think, you know, his actions domestically right now are largely limited to repression. And so I would see, you know, increased repression at home as the economic situation deteriorates. And I think, you know, the other thing that we need to look at, and forgive me for putting this on the table in our discussion, but we also need to have, we need to be very conscious of what, you know, we have a number of Venezuelans here in Miami, including the mother of a fallen hero, Oscar Perez, the soldier who rebelled and was murdered by the Maduro forces. Well, she has been in detention in South Florida and is being threatened with deportation.
And we are going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry to leave it there. Eduardo, thank you for joining us. That was Eduardo Gamarra, professor of political science. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up at 6:30 tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the latest efforts in Wisconsin to improve health care for pregnant women and cut down on premature births and infant mortality.
Now, producers of the Fox TV show Empire say they're removing actor Jussie Smollett from this season's two remaining episodes.
The move came after Smollett was charged with disorderly conduct and falsifying a police report. The actor, who is black and gay, said he was attacked by two men in Chicago who yelled homophobic and racist slurs and told him he was in Trump country. After investigating, police say Smollett set the whole thing up himself because he was unhappy with his salary.
Many liberals on social media initially expressed outrage over the first reports of the attack, calling it a disturbing case of Trump-era racism and hate. Conservatives accused them of rushing to judgment and portraying Trump supporters as bigots. Our next guest says the reaction to the incident is evidence of confirmation bias. Noah Rothman is the associate editor of Commentary Magazine and author of the new book, Unjust: Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's still allegations. The whole story is maybe not quite sorted out, but you wrote about this looking back from this vantage point. What do you think people got wrong after the initial reports?
Well, the desire to treat victims, legitimate victims, with a certain amount of deference and to provide them with psychic and even material rewards is good. It's natural. But when we reduce the barriers, the thresholds, the evidentiary standards that a victim is supposed to meet in order to convey some sort of, or defer rather to some sort of historical sense of justice for aggrieved classes of individuals, we stop treating people like people. And we start treating them like members of a collective tribe. And that is really typical of how the modern social justice movement navigates the environment and the prescriptions that it has for policy and for social change. And this isn't the first time that we've seen hate crime hoaxes. It's only one of the most recent episodes. And we could have known what this looked like if we were cognizant of that pattern and the social justice activism that animates it. But this movement is very critical to reflections. It's very resistant to introspection. And my book is an attempt to force some introspection on this movement, on the social justice activists right and left who have adopted a lot of ideas that are antithetical to the American experiment.
You wrote in that opinion piece you wrote in the New York Times that, in fact, there are real hate crimes up there, and the FBI is reporting that they're on the rise. With that in mind, I mean, are you surprised that people are seeing real hate crimes? They see another report and think, ah, this fits that pattern.
Yeah, so, and this is something I wasn't aware of, but hate crime reports are obviously distinct from hate crime indictments and prosecutions. A lot of new agencies are reporting on this data, and that data comes from 2017, where we had about 7,000 plus reports of hate crime incidents. But in that same year, the number of federal indictments handed down specifically for hate crimes was a whopping eight. With 14 convictions on 14 counts. The notion here that there is some sort of a plague is advanced by the idea that the country as a whole is beset by racial prejudice and bigotry, and it's almost a faith. It's something that is very resistant to factual challenges, and that's not a figment of anybody's imagination. The social justice movement originates out of the church. It is a religious concept originally. Its vestigial religious traits is something that is probably part of its DNA. And the movement as a whole, while dedicated to some pretty noble ideas, the notion that we should how to think about justice and fairness and an egalitarian society, righting historical wrongs, it's pretty unobjectionable. But the movement's activists have embraced ideas in order to affect that sort of change that I think are really psychologically damaging and utterly alien to the American experience. Notions like the fact that meritocracy in this country is a myth, that agency is a lie, that your individual traits, your demography at birth, sets you on a course in life that is in many ways predestined. That's segregation to prevent social discomfort, racial, demographic, or otherwise, is good. And that colorblindness in institutions is naive at best and probably more likely dangerous. And social justice activists on the left might not realize that white supremacists believe all this stuff too. This sort of toxic racial consciousness is at the heart of this movement. It's very damaging. It's certainly counterproductive. And it's something that I think is alien to the American experiment and needs to be stopped.
Talking to Noah Rothman from Commentary Magazine, author of the new book, Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Talk about a piece he wrote about the response to this case in Chicago, the TV actor Jussie Smollett claiming to be the victim of a hate crime, police now charging him with false reports. Noah, is the reaction to this a sign of something to do with the social justice movement, or is this just how we react to stuff on the internet now? We see a thing wherever we are on the political spectrum. We react according to our preconceived notions, and we run with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a distinction without a difference, right? Whether or not how we react to stuff on the internet and whether or not this is a function of the social justice movement. The social justice movement lives on the internet. It thrives in that environment. There are actual serious social consequences for transgressing against the social justice movement's prescriptions and its way of thinking about things. Just deference to its preferred nostrums is really all that it demands of its adherents. And I think really specifically about the phenomenon that resulted from resulted after the erection of a statue in Lower Manhattan, Fearless Girl. Fearless Girl was a bronze statue erected in Lower Manhattan, and it was feted by Democratic speakers and politicians. Bill de Blasio said it was a serious, significant challenge to the patriarchy, and men were very offended by it. Gail Collins in the New York Times said it was the most effective protest against male domination of the financial services industry since the antebellum protests that desegregated the trolleys. It turns out this statue was sponsored by a firm, State Street Global Advisors, which was ostensibly trying to raise awareness for the lack of women in C-suite executive positions in the financial services industry. But it wasn't long before we realized the whole point of this statue. After a Department of Labor audit, they found that this firm had been systematically discriminating against its female employees. It settled with about 305 women to the tune of $5 million. Just paying not deference to the ideas of social justice allowed this firm to evade a lot of scrutiny that it deserved. But because it was able to tug on the heartstrings and demonstrate that its heart was in the right place, it was able to receive some indulgences from the social justice minders who are very aware of transgressions against its norms. This isn't the only case. It's only one of the most prominent. But it's indicative of how this movement is rendered gullible and manipulable by these tenets of what has really become a new faith.
You mentioned earlier the phrase social justice on the left and the right. People, I think, usually associate with the left. Where do you see it on the right?
Yeah, so the social justice movement on the left has embraced a lot of what I said earlier, psychologically damaging concepts, these ideas that amount to the notion that you are a victim in life, that you are unable to navigate society. It is an unnavigable matrix of prejudices with obstacles placed before you by powers that be, which are ill-defined, and they prevent you from realizing your success in life. So much so that you must defer to a higher power, an authority, to restore that which is your due. Again, white supremacists, white nationalists believe all this too. The distinctions between the far left and far right social justice activists in a sort of a mindset, a foundational philosophical approach to life, are so blurred that I often decline to make them. These two ideas, which are relegated only to the fringes now, are being drawn on by the center at increasing rates that I think are very, very disturbing. It's a powerful notion to say to somebody that your lot in life is not of your own making. It disempowers you, but ironically, it's a very effective way of creating a durable political coalition. Conservatives used to know all this stuff. They used to know that identity politics practiced in this fashion was disempowering and detrimental to the social fabric. But its power and its appeal are tempting for individuals who are looking to create a political coalition. And I think that that in many ways, Donald Trump's ascendancy to the White House was predicated on a lot of these notions that the lot of certain people's lives was not in their own making, that higher powers discriminated against your identity, be it white, Christian, male, what have you, that foreign labor and foreign capital were being imported in this country to provide unfair competition and to rob you of your due. That's disempowering. It's a toxic notion. It fosters grievance and identity politics, but it also creates a very durable political coalition. Democrats have known this for a long time, and Republicans are just beginning to catch on.
A social justice advocate, I guess, if we can define a generic term there, might say, okay, for black people in America, they have had the real experience of slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, segregation, separate but equal, and so on, up to redlining in the banks, efforts to prevent them voting, whereas the white nationalists can't point to that experience. Are you saying really they're equally valid?
No.
Or invalid?
Redlining is actually a very specific case, and it shows up in my book. That was an effort by public sector forces, by the government, to facilitate the sort of economic justice that I think a lot of social justice advocates think is valid and necessary today. This is the government knocking on your door saying, I'm here to help. And what they did was actually segregate a lot of urban centers in the effort to keep people in their homes during the Great Depression. That's indicative of sort of the problem that I'm trying to address here, which is that an over-reliance on the private sector to address these grievances is detrimental to the overall cause. This book is not an attack on racial awareness, on self-actualization. That's the sort of thing that I think is arguing from a position of ignorance. What this is an attack on is a certain notion, an idea of social, of racial and cultural awareness as sufficing for a governing ethos. Social justice has become an alternative theory of how societies organize themselves, which is alien to the United States, but not alien to societies abroad. thinking of individuals not as individuals, but as representatives of their particular class or tribe, is really just how politics functions in most of old Europe and in East Asia. It's the sort of thing that I think should be resisted vehemently here, but it's becoming increasingly attractive.
Talking to Noah Rothman, he's the associate editor of Commentary Magazine, author of the book Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America. Our starting point was the Empire actor Jussie Smollett, his case reporting a hate crime, now charged with false reporting.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Smollett story, and especially the early media reports and reactions? What lessons do you hope people learn from this? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're talking with Noah Rothman about Empire actor Jussie Smollett. He says there's a reckoning coming to those who rushed to judgment after Smollett said he was attacked by a couple of racist, homophobic supporters of President Trump. Chicago police said last week that the actor staged the attack because he wasn't happy with his salary.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following that story and the response in the media, social media, and beyond? Do you think we've lost the ability to think critically? Are we too knee-jerk with our reactions? Do you agree with our guest that we might go in with a mindset, a social justice mindset, he says, that makes us judge things maybe before all the facts are in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Noah, bringing things back to this kind of incident, we see shocking incidents reported on, shared, especially on social media all the time. What would you like to see from people in the media, too, on how we react on those initial reports?
Yeah, so, and I'm asked this question a lot, how should we react when these things happen? And the answer is very unsatisfying. It's don't. We do not react. We do not run off half-cocked with the assumption that we understand all these events and by virtue of the players involved. Because in order to make that assessment, we have to rely on stereotypes. We have to see individuals not as individuals, but as representatives of their collective class or tribe. This is indicative of how a lot of these racial hate crime hoaxes, unfold on college campuses, and only recently, after 2016, how they've become an increasingly dominant feature of American political life in this country. What happened to, for example, the individuals who prejudged the situation involving Justice Brett Kavanaugh was very similar. The paucity of evidence before us in that case, hard evidence that we could actually pore over, was such that people began to probe their own personal experiences in order to understand these events. They began to talk about their experiences in college and high school, the people who they knew who were like Brett Kavanaugh. And from there, you had a critical mass of members of the elite community, media, political, entertainment elites, discussing Brett Kavanaugh in a way that in any other context we would describe as prejudice. They talked about him as a white male with a particular socioeconomic background, a member of a class and a tribe that was due a comeuppance, a reckoning. Whether or not he, as an individual, had done any of the things of which he was accused, criminal allegations, albeit not prosecutable allegations, was immaterial almost. The reckoning that was due here, according to people like Matthew Dowd and Maureen Dowd and Hillary Clinton communications advisor Jennifer Palmieri and Martina Navratilova and half a dozen other individuals who are very influential, was that this was a white man who was resistant to this cultural reckoning of which he had been caught up in. That's not any kind of justice. We're not talking about justice anymore. We're talking about revenge, downward social leveling, and whether or not Brett Kavanaugh deserved it or not is immaterial. He was caught up in the currents of history. That's not justice. That's the sort of thing that is very familiar to an anti-egalitarian societies. But that's not this society. That's not the American ideal.
Is this anything that new? You can go back to Aaron Burr being accused, as his post-shooting Alexander Hamilton, being accused of a treason plot that fell apart after a lot of hoopla due to a lot of really not much evidence there. Are times that really that different now? And is it really because of a social justice movement?
No, I mean, it's certainly not new. The tribal impulse is so ingrained in the human condition that it's probably an evolutionary trait. That doesn't make it noble or valid. It's just an acknowledgement that this is with us. The American ideal, when I raise this issue on the American meritocratic egalitarian ideal, when I raise this issue from college campuses, you get a lot of resistance from students who only know of the American ideal that it's failed. We fail to live up to it. So, and if that's all you know, then why would you think it's worth preserving? This, to me, is a misapprehension of what the word ideal is. An ideal is aspirational. You may never achieve it, but that does not give you license to abandon the project, because the fundamental notions at its heart, the really base root concepts that animated the founders, you know, people don't read the Federalist Papers anymore, but they certainly don't read the people who animated the founders. Nobody reads Edmund Burke or Montesquieu anymore. The notions at the heart of the American founding, foundational English common law concepts like the presumption of innocence, have not been improved upon, and the efforts to reboot justice have been abject failures that create a slew of more victims, the most recent example of which is the Dear Colleague Letter, the status quo that resulted from the Dear Colleague Letter in 2011, where we rebooted justice, essentially. It was a guidelines that were provided to college campuses that said how they could essentially redefine sexual assault and adjudicate these claims on campus, because the American justice system was ill-equipped to adjudicate these cases fairly. Evidentiary standards for conviction were too high. Forcing an accuser to confront their abuser was too traumatic. So they had to adjudicate these claims on campus tribunals. And when those verdicts were examined in real courtrooms, they found that accused and accuser of alike were frequently deprived of their First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights. Millions of dollars were handed out to the students who were abused in these tribunals, and all because of an effort to redefine justice along the lines of what social justice advocates think is more valuable. It wasn't justice that they were seeking in the end. It was revenge, and it turned out to create a whole lot more victims.
Do you see a backlash or a positive response, as you would see it, switching things back in another direction?
You know, I wish I did. Unfortunately, I am fighting against the tide. You know, this sort of social justice activism is very popular. I don't foresee any real changes coming anytime soon. Unfortunately, this book is an effort to really begin the process of looking at these members of political coalitions, very important, very influential members of both Republican and Democratic political coalitions, and saying, look, maybe this association just isn't worth it. Maybe we've gotten into bed with some people who are making us less attractive to a critical mass of voters, 50 plus one at the polls. That's the argument that I make in the very final chapters of this book, that certain concepts have rendered these social justice movements less attractive to the political coalitions that they are trying to be a member of. For example, the Democratic Party has had to dissociate itself from the Women's March movement, because of many of the pieties that it had adopted from that are popular on the social justice left, adhering to the theory of intersectionality. Intersectionality is a perfectly valid way to see how prejudice manifests in the real world, but it forced them to look at their allies not as allies, but as disparate members of potential enemy classes. Because some of them had disparate traits that were more discriminated against or less discriminated against than others. So this movement, it was engaged in an anti-Semitism row because its allies, who were Jewish and white, were, in the words of Tamika Mallory, one of the organizers, purveyors of white supremacy, whether they knew it or not. They couldn't possibly be allies, even if they agreed to everything that we believed in. They still possessed these demographic traits that render them something of an adversary. It ended up tearing the movement apart, and it disempowered them, because eventually Democrats had to dissociate from them. I think more and more that's going to continue to happen, and if we can educate individuals as to how these philosophies are robbing them of power, or stealing their agency from them, then I think it becomes less attractive.
We'll leave it there. Noah, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Noah Rothman, associate editor of Commentary Magazine, author of the new book, Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America. We talked about, among other things, actor Jussie Smollett, accused of paying two men to stage an attack on him in downtown Chicago, and our guests saw wider concerns about the social justice movement.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the 2020 presidential race is underway, and so is the media coverage. Our guest says a lot of the 2016 media coverage got it wrong, and there are plenty of ways to get it right this time around.
A growing number of Shopko stores are closing in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll find out how the loss of those stores affects the economy in small communities and what kind of job prospects are out there for laid-off retail workers.
And we'll look at calls to cut pensions for members of Congress.
That look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 7, there are toys marketed for boys, toys marketed for girls, but are those gender-specific toys reflecting reality or shaping it? Kate talks to two experts on gender and toys tomorrow after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then, have you been pushed or maybe guilt-tripped from the couch to the gym by social media? We hear how fitness apps and the internet have changed how we think about our own bodies and exercise. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.